We do have a QR code that's on the store. They're on a couple other panel doors if you don't get this one right in time. But the QR code links you to a survey. We would very much appreciate your feedback for this panel and how it went. And then also, you know, how the hotel's doing, four panels, and how you guys feel with, you know, the general overall panelness of panels. I just made that up. We know you guys take your time out to do surveys, and we see that, you know, your time is worthless. But if you do have a survey done and submitted, is that you will be entered to possibly win one of the panel winners that Brayburn has drawn up. So.
So this is a panel that I did at Vertical Confusion last weekend that had an hour and a half time slot. I have an hour time slot for this one, so I'm going to try to cram as much 80-year history of conventions into this 1 hour. So I can't promise I'll have time at the end for questions and answers, but I think he just told me I'm the very last panel in this panel room. So if we do go slightly over, I'm going to try to finish exactly at 9 if we go slightly over. And if you have any questions, stick around and ask me questions. If not, let's get started. There is no microphone in this room, so I'm going to talk very, very loud. I went to military academy, so I guess I can project a little bit. So let's begin. So I've been working on this project for about over 10 years now. I was surprised to find there has actually never been a book written on conventions in general. Now, individual fandoms have written about their own individual fandom and convention, and some individual conventions have recorded on history, but no one's ever tried to connect all these different conventions together. And this is why I'm trying to show that all these conventions do not exist in different bubbles, that furry cons are as much connected to comic cons, anime cons, Brony cons, and Trek cons. Yes, and
hi.
This is what we're going to try to do with this
game.
Bob, I'm locked out of my room. I left the key. I forgot to bring my key.
Okay, I'll try to let you in. I'll be right up there.
Okay, so. Guys, a little bit about me. I studied genetic biology at Johns Hopkins University. So one thing that I had a lot of work in doing is recording the history of evolutionary biology trees. And I thought I would apply the same technique trying to record the history of all these different convention evolutions into one organic tree. So this is almost 10 years of different variations of the timeline I've been working on. This is one of the more clarified one where I try to show all the different connections. But these are all the different genres I'm going to mainly try to focus and cover on. We're going to start all the way here in the 1930s with the early science fiction cons and work our way down to the modern day. So the specific conventions we are going to try to cover. So here's a more organic one that shows the growth of evolution. The main cons we're going to try to cover before the pre-furry era are the science fiction cons, the comic cons, and the anime cons. And two specific fandoms I'm going to elevate to this level. These are going to be the Star Trek fans and the My Little Pony fans, or the Trekkies and the Bronies. Because the impact that the Trekkies and Bronies had on the convention scene were so impactful, they kind of deserve to be elevated to the same level as the different cons. And of course, we're going to talk about the furry cons, which I have highlighted here in brown, kind of descending from the room party floors of the science fiction cons. But we're going to start here. There is some contention of what is the first convention, and I'm going to lay the argument for the other peoples, and I'm going to talk about what I think the first convention is, because that's going to be an important thing to kind of nail down. So this is the furry tree we're going to be looking at eventually. So first, how do we define a convention? Because it's such a broad term, it could be anything. Is a trade show a convention? Is a meetup a convention? Is an author book signing a convention? Could world fairs be conventions? Are Renaissance fairs conventions? Well, I think we had to kind of narrow down the definition of convention. I'm looking at the Worldcon model style conventions. So conventions that are held over the course of at least 3 days, held in a hotel convention center model that involves pop culture, specifically narrative pop culture. So anything that involves genre or media fiction. So we're going to look at comics, literature, horror, fantasy, science fiction. So everything outside that bubble is going to be nebulous. So there's no conventions for cars, or even video games is a little bit contentious because a lot of video game cons descended from electronic trade shows first. But the original model I want to look at is what is the first convention, and we're going to basically build our foundation on that. So 1938 is the golden age for two important movements. It is the golden age of the science fiction genre, and it's also the golden age of the comic book genres. Two specific fandoms that had such a big impact on the overall conventions. Now, up to this point, conventions were essentially just meetups at people's house. They were meetups in public libraries. These were seen as kind of, you know, high school club meetings. They weren't really the conventions that we would associate with the type of cons that we have now. So the early meetups that a lot of people like to say were the first cons, especially if you go to any old school science fiction convention, they would argue there are two contenders for the first convention. First is FieldCon, held in Philadelphia in 1936, and the other is the British science fiction convention held in 1937. So here they are on the list. These are some of the earliest conventions I could categorize, the dates and the number of attendees. And it is these two conventions that are specifically isolated by the old school science fiction fans of being considered the first convention. What they essentially were one-day meetings at the public library or at an individual's house. They talked about meeting fans from different countries. They only had about 10 attendees at most, and that's it. So you won't see anything that we associate with conventions now. There are no dealer halls, no art shows, no panels, essentially just fans meeting with each other. I always found it interesting that most science fiction fans consider these two the first conventions, yet they leave out the first science fiction league meeting, which actually was held over the course of 2 days and had just as much attendees as PhilCon. So why isn't this considered the first convention? Well, when I ask them, they always say, well, they don't use the term convention or conference in its title. So at that point, it's just semantics. If we're going to use semantics of what is the first convention, then everything is pointless. So they might consider this the first convention, but not this. I don't really consider any of these the first convention as we look at with the current model. My argument will be the first Worldcon in 1939, held over July 4th weekend, and this is why. There are a lot of elements that Worldcon has that really makes it the foundation for a lot of these conventions we're going to talk about. So first, Worldcon was the first convention held over the course of 3 days. It is the first convention to adopt what we now know as the convention hotel model, where specifically the convention will work with the hotel, get a block of rooms specifically for attendees, give a reduced room rate model for all attendees of that convention, then hold programming throughout the weekend. So Worldcon is really the first to do this. Worldcon also had over 100 attendees, so it wasn't just 10 science fiction fans meeting. It was at least in the three digits. And as we'll see in the next slide, it had its own early version of programming. What many people consider the first cosplay done by editor Forrest Ackerman and his girlfriend at the time are considered the first cosplayers. And we also can trace the very first Dead Dog Party to Worldcon. In fact, the first Dead Dog Party was held 4 days after Worldcon, and it was an informal gathering of all the different staffers at the cons at an individual staffer's house where they just kind of drank and celebrated the end of the convention. And also, funny enough, this convention actually made profit, so they didn't end in the red like most cons normally do. Now, a lot of the early elements that we will associate conventions now happened at this first Worldcon. So, for example, the first guest of honor happened at Worldcon. Every single convention, whether you go to an anime con or comic con or even here at FurryCon, you always have a designated guest of honor. Now, at some cons, it's like hundreds of guests of honors, but most cons at least have one designated guest of honor. So, science fiction cons and furry cons still try to keep it at least one in most cases. The concept of having con badges came about from these early world cons, so having a badge for name and con ribbon. So you see a lot of, especially if you go to a lot of old science fiction cons, you have people with rows and rows and rows of ribbons. Well, this started with these early science fiction cons having the tradition of trying to collect different ribbons. So a lot of things we will associate with conventions, you can clearly see start forming at this very first Worldcon that you did not see at the previous one-day events. Now, I said they actually had the first programming. So at the previous conventions, these, again, were just meetings between different science fiction fans around the world. It wasn't really a designated event schedule with different topics to talk about. But the first Worldcon had the very first prototype convention panel, where there would be one panel room, everyone would meet, there would be specific topics that are talked about, then there would be a break between each panel, people would go get drinks, go to lunch, or get coffee, then they come back the next hour and meet and talk about a different subject. So this is the programming book from the very first Worldcon. As you can see, it actually had specific programming for each of the 3 days. Funny enough, the final day actually had a baseball game between the science fiction fans of New York and Philadelphia. And that's actually one contradiction I kind of wish continued on to the modern day, because it wouldn't be fun if every single furry con ended with a baseball game between furries and Trekkies or furries and Bromies. Like, that would be awful. Like, I wish they continued that tradition. One Oklahoma fan made a zine, fanzine, reporting his experience at the very first Worldcon. And what's the first thing that came to mind when we talked about the first Worldcon? Well, the long badge pickup line at the very first Worldcon. Well, if you were waiting to get your badge here at A&E and think, oh, what's with modern cons having so many attendees that you have to wait in line for hours just to get your badge? Well, just realize the very first con, that was also an issue. This is Worldcon in Washington, D.C., 80 years later. I took this picture in the lobby. So again, lines to pick up your badges, con tradition. It's always been there since the beginning. Now, one thing that a lot of these science fiction cons had were room party signs. And you'll see this if you are a furry, because most furry cons also have room party floors. If you were at Perfect Confusion last weekend, it has a designated room party floor. Now, you have to remember, science fiction is a catch-all designated term for all general pop culture during this period. So nowadays, we retroactively call this period speculative fiction, but really, when you're talking about science fiction around this time, it covers fans of cartoons, fans of the comics, fans of fantasy, fans of space opera. So almost every single genre that you could kind of think of, every single new medium that you could think of, would be under the umbrella of science fiction. So if you want to meet with your fellow like-minded fans during this time period, how would you do it? Well, nowadays, if you go to an anime con or a comic con, for example, there are specific meetups for specific fan groups. Even here at furry cons, you have meetups for specific species. At this period, there is no way to really meet with your fans unless you have the designated room for that. So a lot of these old science fiction cons will have this giant bulletin board in the lobby. This one, I think, specifically existed for 40 years. I think they kind of gave birth. This one probably gave birth to the furry fandom. But specifically, what they will do is have slots where someone would write their room numbers. Let's say fans of Doctor Who meet in Hyatt 506 at 8 p.m. and will watch a lot of Tom Baker episodes. Basically, that's what you would do. You would put your room number down, you would say what fandom you were a part of and what time to meet up, and this is how you would meet up with your like-minded fans around this time period. What's interesting enough, because the furry cons descended directly from the science fiction con, and you see this con party tradition continue on. That's why you go to a lot of old-school furry cons, like Furry Confusion, for example, there's a room party floor with specific themed room parties. BabsCon, uniquely enough, is the only BronyCon. Well, a lot of BronyCons are descended from different fandoms, but the only BronyCon that had a direct influence from the science fiction scene was BabsCon. And BabsCon, for the longest time, used to be the only BronyCon that had also a room party floor. And in fact, what WorldCon is essentially, you can think of it similar to the Olympics or the World's Fair. You did not specifically, so there's no universal board or group or committee around Worldcon. Worldcon is not in any specific city. It's always bidded on and voted on with bids by different communities across the country, across the world, and each of them would post their own bid for, we want to host Worldcon in Louisiana, we want to host it in Los Angeles, and normally the bidding group will have to throw a room party, and it's normally the best room party that will win the bid to host the next Worldcon. So it's important to have a really good party. This is the way to kind of get people to go to your convention. So it's unique because it's a torch that's been handed down for over 80 years, and I'm surprised no one has tried to ever take over it. It's kind of been passed down by fans, which is fun and unique. Another thing I really like from Worldcon and these old science fiction cons are they would used to have these mimeograph newsletter updates almost every half day to update people. Oh, this panel moved to this room. Oh, this guest speaker dropped out, so we're going to have a replacement speaker. Oh, this autograph signing is now happening in this room. So nowadays, we have the internet. We have Twitter. So most cons will update everybody on Twitter if there's a change in programming or events. But back in the day, you can't really do that. So a lot of cons will have a mimeograph machine where they will produce a new update letter once or twice a day that will fill in the convention attendees of what is happening. And this is from one of the World Cons I went to recently. I like that they kept this tradition going. So that's an example of some of the updates that they've had. And as Worldcon really started to set the model, you start seeing the different variations of Worldcon add new and more elements. I was just at Chicago last year. Last year, Chicago got to hold its sixth Worldcon, which unique about Chicago is also held the second Worldcon in 1940. It was the first Worldcon that we would consider had a cosplay lounge. It essentially, one attendee just allowed her hotel room to be the place where you could change to cosplay. That kind of became the first cosplay lounge. It was also the first convention that had the first cosplay masquerade. So nowadays we have costume contests or masquerade balls. All this really started with the first cosplay masquerade before the term cosplay even existed at the very first Chicago Worldcon or ShyCon for short. In fact, we could probably see fursuiters having dance competitions as a natural evolution of this in the furry fandom. Now, the Worldcon model started to expand to a bunch of different conventions. One is WesterCon, because Worldcon could be held in any city around the world. People wanted to create an alternative that they always had a science fiction convention to go to within North America. So WesterCon was created. So specifically held every year and bidded within North America specifically. And then all the elements I just told you of why I defined WorldCon as the first convention will just kind of throw out the window, because you had a concept of MidwestCon, which created the concept of Relaxicons. So Relaxicons basically had no programming, had no dealers, had no art show, nothing. It was essentially, we just book a hotel and you just throw your own room parties there. So this is where you get the concept of a Relaxicon. In fact, if you think about it, in the furry fandom, we have Furry Fiesta, and we have a sister event, Furry Siesta, which is a more laid-down, relaxed version of that. You could think of Furry Siesta as a Relaxicon for the furry fandom. The other thing that also started at WorldCon, especially in the 50s, was the Hugo Awards. The Hugo Awards are kind of considered the most prestigious literary award in the science fiction community. In fact, in most cases, it's on par with the Academy Awards or the Emmys. But what's unique about the Hugo Awards is it's only voted on by the attendees of that year's WorldCon. So if you were an attendee at WorldCon, you had a say on who was winning that Hugo Award. And that's actually very unique because, like I said, the WorldCon can be held at any city around the world. So in the years where WorldCon might be held in Japan, you might see a lot of Japanese authors and science fiction works win the Hugo Awards. When it's held in Europe, you normally see a lot of European creators and works win the awards. But since it's often held in America, you see a more American-centric voting with Hugo Awards. But again, very prestigious, and it's unique that it's only con attendees that can vote on that award. Another important innovation that started at these early conventions is the concept of folk music. Now, folk music is interesting because actually the term for folk came from a typo for folk in one of the essays in 1955. But the roots for folk music came all the way back to the very first Worldcon and beforehand. So you have to remember, some of the people who helped found the first Worldcon were part of a New York group called the Futurians, or the Futurians, who were essentially a more workers, socialist type group that wanted to fight against the elements that brought on the Great Depression. Because you have to remember, right before these cons started up, you had a period of the Great Depression. So a lot of these Futurians would sing protest music. And these protest music songs were carried over to these early World Con and science fiction events where people would randomly find an empty panel room, take out a guitar and start singing these protest songs, and other attendees will just join in the panel room and start singing, or they'll find a random piano in the lobby of the hotel, start playing, and people will join in and start singing. Over time, the words to these protest songs were forgotten, and people started to make up their own songs based on their favorite science fiction characters. So this was really popular with Star Trek fans. They would make their own songs with Star Trek characters. And then you have this evolution of folk music from being to cheery and protest songs to now fan music for their favorite pop culture characters. And this tradition of organic folk music still continues around. In almost every furry con, you're also in the hotel with a piano in the lobby. Eventually, someone will go up to that piano and start playing, and you'll see a bunch of attendees gather around and sing with them. You also, late at night, will have empty panel rooms, so people will just come in, bring their instruments, and start playing. The tradition of folk music continues to this day. In fact, if you go to BronyCons have something called a Renegade Stage, which is specifically a room designated for musicians who might not have been able to get into the main concert lineup, who are able just to bring their own musical instruments and play for attendees for fun. So, the root of all convention music can come from this early folk music. Now, as we go to the next period in the 60s, we start to see two different eras. So first, the golden age of both science fiction and comics end. Specifically, the golden age of science fiction ended when you have the speculative fiction split, where you have fantasy go into the high fantasy tradition, influenced by Lord of Rings and the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, where fantasy becomes more of an escapist form of literature, and you have people trying to rebel against this more escapist form of literature with the works of Michael Moorcock, working on New Worlds Literary Magazine, who started a new type of science fiction trend called New Wave Science Fiction, which looked at science fiction in a more deconstructive route. Essentially, it brought on the era of dystopian type science fiction stories, where while the Golden Age science fiction could be argued was basically cowboys in space, cowboys conquering space, glorious Golden Age for humankind, a lot of the New Wave science fiction said, hey, if we don't fix your society now, we're going to end up in a very, very horrible environment, which is why you start getting works like 1984, Brave New World, these types of dystopian fiction as a counter to the escapist high fantasy that you start seeing around this time. This is where you slowly start seeing science fiction and fantasy split. But in the comics genre, you had an interesting reaction. So, after the GIs came back home from the war during the Golden Age of comics, they didn't like the idea of having superheroes just instantly punch Hitler and instantly the war is done. So the comics genre kind of to start going away from superheroes around this time period, and they started to go to more different genres. So monster genres, a horror genre, romance genres. It was really when DC and Marvel had their own unique innovations, specifically Flash of Two Worlds and Marvel making Fantastic Four and Spider-Man, that you had a new type of superhero come onto the scene, which reinvigorated the superhero genre in comics, not just reinvigorated, it kind of took over, where at this point superheroes were probably just a small percentage of all the different genres being told in comics. Now you have superhero essentially becoming 90% of what's being told in comics. So during the Silver Age of comics, comics were now standing on its own as kind of separate from this whole entire science fiction wave. So there were a lot of ideas on a lot of these early fanzines, where this is the early form of, you know, social media connection. You would write letters to each other in these old fanzines. That a lot of comic book fans were saying, we need to have our own convention if we're ever going to be considered a legitimate fandom. Dr. Julius Bales in 1962 basically said the comics fandom will not be a fandom in its own right until it's held its own convention. And this is what two high school kids essentially did with New York Comic Con, also called the Straw Tri-State Convention. It was actually a one-day, six-hour event where they actually had a very, very small dealers hall. So you can kind of see there's like only six tables and a bunch of chairs. These aren't comm chairs, but it's just a bunch of chairs. And it was essentially a small dealer's hall where you had six dealers sell. It was technically the only convention that Steve Ditko has ever been to. He just popped in one day, he just popped in and said hi. And within 6 hours, you have what most people consider the first comic convention. Again, by my WorldCon definition, I would say it has to be at least 3 days. But because the comic book fandom kind of universally say this is the archetype for what they consider the first convention, I will allow this as being considered the first comic book convention, since a lot of sources kind of say this. So before then, most comic book fans met up, like the old science fiction fans, in someone's house, or they would trade comics in these swap meets or garage sales. So it was with this type of new convention that you had the introduction of a new type of element into the convention scene. This is where you get the creation of the Artist Alley. So when you think about how most science fiction cons only had one guest of honor, the comic book fandom has a potential for a lot of different guests of honor, but of course it's expensive to pay for each guest of honor. You have to pay for a hotel, you have to pay for the travel. So a lot of these early comic book organizers thought, hey, why don't we get a lot of comic book artists to come to our con for free, and we'll just give them a table. You can have your own table, you can sell your own artwork, you can do on-site commissions, you can do book signings, and that's a great way to get a lot of big names onto your convention without actually paying them a guest fee. And this is where you get the creation of one type of artist alley, the Comic-Con style artist alley. And I have to say this because the term artist alley refers to many different types of things depending on what con you go to. But specifically for the first type of artist alley, this is where we get the Comic-Con style artist alley. Now, two other individuals around this time. So you had Shel Dorf, who was from Michigan, who was involved with the Detroit Triple Fanfare, and you had Ken Kruger, who actually attended the very first WorldCon, who helped run his own little small con in his mother's house called Buffalo Con. Both of them actually ended up becoming friends and moving to San Diego in 1970. And together with another two individuals, they basically created the Golden State Comic Book Convention, which we now know as San Diego Comic Con. And this started by these group of old school science fiction fans who grew up with these science fiction cons as kids, who decided to take the formula and make their own convention. This is where we get the modern concept of the exhibitor hall with dealers selling old comic books and the artist alley. Now, you had the underground comic book movement around this time also take place in Japan with something called Doujinshi Culture. So one of the science fiction cons in Japan had an area specifically for comic book artists. So we would call them zine artists in America, but these are Doujinshi artists in Japan who would take popular anime or manga characters and do their own little fan-made comic. They're only 10 to 20 pages. These are very similar to something that we had in the 20s in America called Tijuana Bibles. And in both cases with Doujinshi and Tijuana Bibles, 99% of it was smutty adults, you know, shipping of characters together. So when people say, oh, why is modern fan fiction all filled with not safe for work adult situations? Well, it's been around since this type of fan comic has existed. So this comic circle, this comic market in the science fiction convention in Japan became so big they decided to spin it off. And essentially the comic market, now known as Comic Cat, was born, and they created the second type of artist alley. So the first type of artist alley that we saw in the comic convention scenes were done by professional artists. These are professional artists who were working on titles that they were working with companies for, so they had the legal rights to draw these fictional characters. But then you have a second type of artist alley, the Comic Cat artist alley, where these are all fan artists who are drawing unauthorized fan work of copyrighted characters. And you can kind of see how that becomes tricky, because if you're an artist and you apply to an artist alley, it might be one where you had to be a professional, and if not, then you know Marvel or DC could come and just say, oh, you're selling our stuff illegally, we're going to take you to court, or you had to, you know, or you could only sell fan art, and you see this a lot where a lot of comic book creators by accident go fan at anime cons, and they're surrounded by all these body pillows and giant artwork that they just can't compete with. So you have these two differently existing artist alleys. Right now, they're separating in different spheres. It's only when the anime cons come to America that that'll start being a problem. We don't have to worry about that until the 90s. So let's continue on. So right here, we can see the old school science fiction fans branching off into the anime cons. We have the Doujinshi cons coming off here with Comic Cat. And this is where we get into this more big bubble. I try to keep all the science fiction cons kind of gathered, so fantasy, science fiction, horror are still very, very similar in roots, so I kind of keep them in the same category. But you start seeing a lot of different elements splintering inside. And we're going to look more into this because we have the next big major fandom come about, the Trekkies. So, very, very quickly, Gene Roddenberry did a big announcement at WorldCon. They are making a new show called Star Trek. Essentially, he was doing what DC and Marvel were doing now at San Diego Comic-Con, New York Comic-Con, announcing the next big work. He was doing this, like, decades ahead of time, announcing his new show called Star Trek. He obviously pitched it to the right audience because you had a big group of Star Trek fans come about from this geeky, nerdy circles. In fact, the Star Trek fandom became so big, they started to overwhelm a lot of these science fiction cons. Because you have to remember, up until this point, from the 30s all the way now to the 70s, almost every single con only had one panel room, and there was only like one panel schedule happening at the same time. So when you all of a sudden have a lot of Star Trek panels popping up, you're going to have a lot of old-school science fiction fans who don't care about this new hipster show, so they're not going to be going to these panels. So, eventually, after 40 years, someone got the brilliant idea. What if we had more than one panel room? And we could have more than one panels. And boom, the concept of the multi-track programming was born. In fact, the programming track is now kind of instrumental for a lot of these old conventions, where you have programming rooms, panel rooms, specifically for one category. So there might be a programming room that's specifically for writing, or one that's specifically for costume making, or one specifically for alternate history, for example. And you start seeing more diversity in the different types of panels. So you can now pick and choose your panels instead of everyone going to the same panel at the same time. But the Star Trek fans were still overwhelming that they decided, hey, let's spin off and make our own convention. And the first Star Trek con, Star Trek Lives, was so big, it had 3,000 attendees. I mean, think about that. Like, I don't even think this con has hit 3,000 attendees yet. That's really, really big for a first-time convention for this small new fandom. You have to remember, this is really the first type of con for a franchise-specific fandom. Not a genre, franchise-specific fandom. The second year it was held, attendance double. It had 6,000 attendees. The third year, it had 50,000 attendees. So large that they turned away the 6,000 attendees, basically the same number they had the previous year away, because they just couldn't fit everyone in the same hotel.
That's
so the Star Trek fandom just boomed.
Unique badge.
What?
Do you know if that's turnstile attendance or unique badge?
I think that's unique badges at that point. Alright, so, let me see where we get. As big as the Star Trek cons boomed on the scene, they also quickly fizzled out. Because you have to remember, this is a few years after the original series was over, and Next Generation won't happen for another 2 decades. So the Star Trek fandom boomed and quickly shrank. But the conventions they built were so strong, they decided, let's naturally continue these conventions. And this is where a lot of Star Trek cons evolved to become multimedia or genre cons. So essentially, as I was saying, science fiction cons were the main pop culture con up to this period. Now science fiction cons started to become more hard SF, so dealing with space opera, hard science fiction type stories. So the Star Trek cons reformed to kind of pick up this mainstream pop culture route and become new types of conventions. And this is where we get a lot of innovations in the con scene that we kind of associate with cons now. So the term Gopher from Con Volunteer formed around the same time. You started to get the formation of a lot of con security groups. So if you were at for the Confusion last weekend, you had Flare, which is kind of their local security group. The Dorsey Wranglers are normally the ones that used to service Anthrocon and a lot of the Midwest conventions. And even Term Cosplay was eventually coined around
this. And by the way, Flare was amazing last weekend at FC.
They were amazing. They were very good. And it's great that that groups like that still exist. So, we had to go to the next thing. So, quickly put, the 80s were kind of known as the animation dark ages for both anime and Western cartoons, but the circulation of a lot of anime from Japan started becoming popular in the convention scene. So, a lot of room parties started to become viewing parties for a lot of the anime that was coming around this time. So, we're going to talk about this period right here. Okay. So, anime, called Japanimation back then, because the term anime wasn't popularized, was normally only regionally broadcast in the United States on like the West Coast or Hawaii. You never saw full national broadcasting of Japanese anime in America. So a lot of fans of these anime shows would record them and show them at these room parties. These room parties started becoming so big that eventually a lot of them thought, hey, why don't we just make a specific convention for Japanimation? This is where we get the birth of the anime-style con in America. So the anime-style cons come from American science fiction con roots. But now you have the Dondinchi Japanese cons now coming in back into the market and introducing a lot of new elements. First, it introduced the Japanese style, the Artist Alley, again, the fan-run Artist Alley, to America. Second, it brought with it the Japanese style of concerts and raves. And it's interesting if you look at the timeline, because every single con that was founded before anime cons emerged in America, they might have music, but they don't have big concerts or dances. So you don't see comic cons, for example, have concerts to dances. It's only after the anime, all the cons that are formed after anime cons, so you have the Brony and the Furry cons, that you start seeing concerts and dances. So it's something that the anime cons brought to the scene. Now, a lot of these room parties that were spreading a lot of these Japanese tapes were brought by a lot of different Japanese fan groups. One of the more popular fan groups was the Cartoon Fantasy Organization, and you might notice the animal there, even though it's specifically for Japanese animation, a lot of the mascots that they use were anthropomorphic animals, and you'll start seeing a lot of fans of Japanese anime liking a lot of the anthropomorphic animal stories that were emerging around this time.
Mark Morimoto, yes.
There we go, right there.
Yeah.
So, the mascot of the Cartoon Fantasy Organization is this creature called Skeletor, which is a kind of alien hybrid weasel-like looking creature. There is actually a house specifically for them.
Yep. They're having a party right now as we speak.
Yes, they're having a party. So
I got my message.
And you partake in
Ron and Mark know them here in Boston.
Yes.
So, yeah.
What's funny is if you guys saw the furry documentary, if you notice, the animal on the cover is also a modernized version of that. So, again, we have a lot of old-school furries here who could probably tell you more about the history around this time than I ever could. But I'm going to tell you the quick things. So, the Francis Gilletier parties, that's happening now, started becoming, after the anime cons started having their own unique parties and started branching off into their own separate conventions, the groups that used to host these anime viewing parties kind of continued and naturally evolved into the furry room parties. Now, the term furry wasn't coined around this time, and we can even go back to the indie comics that we talked about in the 60s, where we have a lot of furry anthropomorphic fanzines. So again, it's a lot of different elements. Like I said, it's a giant tentacle monster all combining together. But the Francis Gilletier Party at WesterCon is, in 1985, is considered the first funny animal fan party. So this is before we had the term furry. And even Comic-Con was hosted that same year, an anthro fandom party in its hotel. So eventually, the next year, the term furry was finally used to refer to this specific party. And again, just like the anime room parties beforehand, these furry room parties got so big, a lot of them said, hey, why don't we just branch off and form our own conventions? So these individuals, Mark and Rod, decided to take this concept of the furry room parties that they had and decided to create the first FurryCon conference. So Conference Zero happened in, I think we have a Conference Zero poster on the very far end. Towards the end of the 90s, had 65 attendees. And what's unique, unlike the comic cons and anime cons, basically carbon copied the structure of science fiction cons onto the furry scene. So they kept the hotel room rate model, they kept how panels were run, they kept the badge pickup line, which is why the badge pickup line for furry cons are also as long as the science fiction con lines. And it's ironic because furries, of all the con attendees, are the most technologically advanced, yet for the longest time, the furry cons, if you go to furry cons even as late as the 2010s, looked like they were run like science fiction cons from the 90s. They were kind of kept in a bubble, and I'll explain why they were kept in the bubble in a bit. But at this time, conference was actually the genericized term for furry cons. So furry cons didn't have a genericized term, but conference was kind of used as that genericized term. As we'll see, we'll have conference each, which eventually gave way to Anthrocon. But the first furry con to get over 1,000 attendees was conference, and it got as high as 1,200 attendees before finally ending in 2003. One of the, I guess, related groups that formed from the California's furry scene was Critic Con Diego, which was essentially a small casual get-together because San Diego Comic-Con ends doesn't have any evening events. Even nowadays, it doesn't really have as much evening events. So it was a way for a bunch of furries to kind of get together at a local hotel, have a small dealer's den, and basically sell furry artwork. So especially a small get-together for furries. So like I said, a conference was a genericized term for furry cons around this time. And when we got conference each, it was not connected to the original one that was founded in California, but it was seen as a way to kind of get its own equivalent. Now, remember when I talked about PhilCon, a lot of people consider the very first science fiction con. Well, it still exists today, but a lot of people thought around this time it had an anti-furry prejudice because it would not accept a lot of furry artists and artwork into the dealer's hall or the art show. So Conference East was kind of formed in retaliation to this perceived anti-furry prejudice from PhilCon. And it was held initially in October and November, which was considered much too cold, which is funny because the biggest furry con we have now is Midwest Fur Fest, which is held in the coldest part of the month. Eventually, Conference East kind of had some organizational issues. A lot of the main core groups reformed with Albany AmperCon in 1997. And it was moved to July 4th weekend. Again, similar to the first WorldCon, now it moves to July 4th weekend, which probably is now too hot since everyone's wearing fursuits, and eventually dropped Albany and just became AmperCon. AmperCon, for the longest time, was the largest convention in the furry scene. It was the first to break 5,000 attendees, until Midwest Fur Fest surpassed it in 2018 with 10,000 attendees. Now, during this period, just like the Trekkies before and just like the Bromies after, the furries were kind of victim to the local media. So when the Trekkies came about, it was the birth of the local news. When the Bromies came about, it was the birth of online journalism. Furries came about during the birth of the 24-hour news cycle. And in each of these three cases, you would have local news reporters with nothing to report on, wanting to have some news to talk about. So what do? If there's a convention in town, what do? You go down there? Do you look at the great art? Do you hear the great philosophical panels? No. You see funny people in funny outfits. In the case of the Bromies, people dressed like males, dressed like weird female ponies. With the case of the Trekkies, all these nerds who are dressing like weird space aliens. Furries, all these people weirdly dress as giant animals. What's odd is while the comic book fans and the Bromies and the Trekkies were considered virgin man children who needed to get a life, the furries had the exact opposite reaction, where, oh, they must be something doing something very devious and adult behind the scenes. Why don't they want us there? And so a lot of the furry cons had to react against this wave of negativity and start banning media and press from there. In fact, if you read a lot of comic books, media, you can't be associated with media, you can't talk with media, so a lot of it was banned. But also, a lot of the furry cons started to become paranoid that other fandoms might be making fun of them and started to hire within their own communities. Now, if you go to any city, major city around the United States, Baltimore, Seattle, Dallas, almost you would have a local group of con volunteers and con runner help each other out. Now, they might not be the fans of these specific cons, but you often see groups of people who work for anime cons also help run science fiction cons and also help run comic cons. And through this, they're able to share and innovate and make new innovations in how to run the con stuff. Because the furry cons were a little bit afraid of recruiting from the outside, they kind of stayed shut in this 90s science fiction con bubble, where they did not get any of these new innovations, new technologies. And it wasn't until the furry cons really started opening up in the late 2010s that all of a sudden, you know, the furry cons started to innovate again and the attendance number kind of jumped up again. But you kind of had this stagnated period for this long a time for furry cons. One of the ways they tried to change the image was re-ingratiate themselves with the community in the form of helping run charities. While cons before them had charities, charities became a major focus for a lot of furry cons. In fact, again, after the furry cons came, almost every other con had charities. So brony cons that came after furry cons, also big with charities. And by hopefully raising money for these local charities, it was a way to re-ingratiate themselves with the communities. And you see this working especially with AmperCon in Pittsburgh. In fact, Pittsburgh now involves AmperCon with the local art culture. It gets funding from the city's art scene. And in fact, the relationship with, if you've ever been to Pittsburgh during AmperCon, you have all these stores welcoming furries. It's great. I even think the relationship between AmperCon and Pittsburgh is stronger than San Diego and Comic-Con. So you see the furries kind of take a hit, kind of stay hidden for a period, but we eventually came back strong and running. And this is where we get into the next phase. So while the furries were kind of on the down low, you had this different period happening in the 90s, especially in the comic book scene. So first, you had the comics bust and boom period. I only have about 10 minutes left, so I'm going to quickly go through them. But then you start having this rise of comic book conventions where people start to corporatize comic cons. You have to remember, before this period, everything was a fan-run volunteer thing, and now you see a lot of groups saying, hey, we could make money off of this. One of the earliest ones is Fan Expo Canada, which eventually started to buy different conventions around the country, like Dallas Comic Con, and rebranded as Fan Expo Dallas. Wizard Magazine, which was a magazine that kind of speculated on the price of comic books in the 90s, decided to buy one of the oldest comic cons, Chicago Comic Cons, and rebrand it as Wizard World Chicago. So you start seeing these groups switch from their original purpose once they start to see the speculators market within the comic book fandom and start wanting to have a role in that by taking over pre-existing volunteer-run cons. San Diego Comic-Con also underwent a change. This is when it rebranded as Comic-Con International, and it started to try to take over different comic groups. So WonderCon was taken over by San Diego Comic-Con in 2001. Alternative Press Expo was taken over in 1998. And in 2004, San Diego Comic-Con expanded to Hall H, now consuming the entire San Diego Convention Center. And this is where we get into some theories. When was it that San Diego Comic-Con became really, really popular? There is no specific explanation. My theory is really around this time period, 2007-2008, when two big movies came about around this time. First, you had The Dark Knight. Second, you had Iron Man. Two movies that kind of changed the scene of comic book superhero movies. Both of them starred A-list actors. Some of these A-list actors were now coming to these conventions and actually speaking and mingling with attendees, making big announcements. Get to remember around this time, most of the guests at these conventions did not have fans in the mainstream public. These were most often C or D list actors from old TV shows or comic book writers no one's ever heard of. But everyone knows Robert Downey Jr., for example, and now you have this idea, this shift, where the public is now seeing geek culture as popular, and you start seeing a lot of people try to market off that. So, for example, this is where you get the rise of like Funko and Loot Crate and Loungefly, all these different companies trying to make their way and make money off this thing. And I really think it started around with Iron Man and The Dark Knight came about, because afterwards, you start to see San Diego tickets sell out really fast. Before then, you could still walk up to San Diego Comic-Con, they buy a one-day ticket and get in. Now, San Diego Comic-Con tickets sell within seconds. So, it's like
seconds, literally. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. So, another big con that happened around the time, New York Comic-Con, completely unrelated to the first New York Comic-Con I was talking about, had two interesting founders. So you had, let me see if it's on the next slide. Yeah, so these are two individuals. So you had Greg, who was a VP of Reed Exhibitors, and they eventually branched off when they saw conventions being so big. They branched off to focus on pop culture conventions, and they now are known as Reed Pop. And you had Ben, who after leaving New York Comic Con started Left View Media. Their first con was Awesome Con, so these are the two co-founders of New York Comic Con. What's funny, one went off to form Reed Pop, one went off to form Left View Media. Two local Pacific Northwest cons founded by the same group, Emerald City Comic Con and Rose City Comic Con. Well, Repop of Emerald City Comic Con and Leftview about Rose City Comic Cons. And then when it came time to kind of go into the anime con space, Repop decided to help make Crunchyroll Expo, while Leftview Media decided to run a bunch of anime cons powered by Crunchyroll. So it's this like weird incestuous a competition between these two original founders of New York Comic Con, which I kind of think is funny, but it also strips the personality that a lot of these original cons had. All right, who here is a brony, or who here is involved with 25? Okay, so we have a few bronies here. So this is where we get the unique marriage between furries and Trekkies that become the BronyCon scene. And you might think, wait, bronies, how are they able to have such a big impact on the convention scene? Well, it's interesting because the bronies were the first to hit 10,000 attendees 3 years before furries even hit 10,000 attendees. And they brought a lot of things that furry cons later adapted. But let's kind of talk about the first BronyCon, which was founded as a hybrid of both Trekkie and furry cons. So an individual called Purple Tinker was the founder of what we now consider the first BronyCon. She was ousted out, and eventually it was taken by Lunar Solace Corporation and moved to Baltimore in 2013. 2 years later, in 2015, it surpassed the 10,000 attendee mark, again, 3 years before Midwest Fur Fest even hit that attendance number. And the formula she used was adapting the show-style guest model that the Trekkies had and the dealer's den model and programming that the furries had. Now, this is where there were some contingencies that that she specifically predicted that kind of fell out. Unlike the Star Trek fandom, which is a fandom for the Star Trek franchise, so all different incarnations, the original series, Next Generation's J.J. Abrams movie to the new CBS stuff, My Little Pony is very unique because the bronies are not a fan of My Little Pony as a franchise. They're a fan of just one generation of My Little Pony, Generation 4. They don't care about the first ones. And Generation 4 was in its second season when these early Pony Cons were founded. There's only 6 main characters voiced by 4 VAs. And when you had 50 Pony Cons around the world fighting for these 4 VAs, 2 of them are notoriously hard to get, so you're really fighting for 2 of them, it becomes very, very tricky. And you could wear out and tire out a lot of these conventions. Now, this is a very tricky period because Hasbro anytime could put a band hammer down and say, no, these cons can't exist. Which is why when you think about it, cons that should be bigger, Harry Potter fandom is bigger, the Twilight fandom is bigger. You never really hear or see about Twilight or Harry Potter cons because J.K. Rowling and Warner Brothers put the band hammer down. So bronies were in this really precarious situation where literally you can invite guests to the cons, overwhelm them with doing all these autograph signings and panels, and next day they go to the recording studio and it's like, yeah, they talk to co-workers, yeah, let's not do these pony cons anymore. They really overwhelm us. And this almost happened with an event called Las Vegas as Unicon. This was the precursor to what we see as DashCon. This was even worse than DashCon. Long story short, they invited all these guests. They couldn't pay for the hotel rooms. They started kicking out a lot of big sponsors from their hotels. Dealers couldn't handle real money. They didn't get paid. The entire Brony fandom, which was fighting around this time, almost fell apart and collapsed. Luckily, through a fundraiser, the bronies actually came together, united, saved the small con, and eventually, like, okay, let's calm down. There's like 50 Pony Cons happening around the country at the same time. That's more than all the Doctor Who, Star Trek, and Harry Potter Cons happening at the same time. So let's concentrate on specific regions of the United States, and let's put some contingencies in place to prevent another Unicon from happening. So one of the contingencies they put in place, so this is Unicon, this is the paper money that vendors had to handle because we couldn't handle real money. A lot of the memes that came from that one event. So one of the contingencies they came up was creating a new department called a VIPR, the VIP Relations Department, sometimes shortened to VIPR. It was essentially a way to cater to the guests of each of these cons to make sure they're treated and not overwhelmed. Because you have to remember, the comic cons and anime cons around this time invite hundreds of guests, shove them through autograph signings, shove them through all these signings. A lot of old school fans call these cattle cons because they're just lines to wait for these people. There's no organic communication. And most of the times you tire out these people and they never want to come back to your con again. The VIPR department was kind of a way to try to cater and make sure these guests were not overworked. And since then, a lot of cons adapted and actually incorporated this brony-created department into their events. Sometimes it's called guest relations, sometimes it's called the green room, but they adapted this model into their event. In fact, after Unicon happened, not just all the brony cons, all the different cons, the comic cons, the anime cons, all had emergency meetings to prevent something from happening. Unfortunately, DashCon happened shortly afterwards, so I guess the other cons were not as prepared. Now, what's interesting about BronyCons are a lot of the founders and chairs of BronyCons are trans women specifically. So you'll see a lot of new innovations on the progressive scene from that side. So the BronyCons on a whole were the first to introduce the gender pronoun ribbons. You notice why FurryCons now have it? Because the bronies really adopted it en masse and it made its way eventually to the BronyCon scene, to the FurryCon scene. The communication tags were first created at used at BronyCon 5 years before Midwest FurFest did, and bronies also incorporated gender-neutral bathrooms as kind of a default for the conventions, which is why a lot of cons now use gender-neutral bathrooms as well. So while these elements were carried over from this one specific group, there was a whole group in the brony fandom called Cutie Corral that used to make these little felt plushies. And after they realized, hey, we need more Pony Cons to sell our plushies at, they started to get into the business of running cons, and they created Windy City Pony Con and Ponyville Satterfest to kind of, you know, have more places to sell their plushies. Then they realized, hey, furries are where the money's at. Kitty Corral eventually became Lumberjack, And they rebranded as Corridor Events, I rebranded as Corgi Events, and they started to run and start a lot of furry cons in the furry scene. So Denver, Sin City, Murcon, in the Desert, Aquata Furry, even at a time owned Anime Milwaukee before they sold it off. So while you see a lot of elements that the furries, that the bronies started now making their way into the furry scene is because Kyuji Corral was essentially the repop of the brony, of the furry fandom, and brought a lot of the elements that they carried over from the brony fandom over to the furry side, which is why we have the big concerts now at furry cons. Like the dance competitions are kind of unique to furries, but the big concerts are something that bronies started to do. A lot of bronies have actually expanded into a lot of different media now. And when the final My Little Pony show ended in 2019, there was a lot of memes and jokes that, okay, the brony fandom's over, so you had a lot of bronies scaring back into the furry side, so this is where you get the large influx of a lot of brony artists and musicians, myself included, and this is where we kind of talk about the concept of volunteer cons versus the callow cons, the pro cons. So there's a difference between the repop, the corgi event style cons, and the, you know, the casual nice volunteer run cons. And there's a lot of different arguments, because this is where I coined the term bandy cons, because there is a method that people want to be popular within the fandom, and if you don't have talent as a musician or artist, most of the times you just create your own con. If you have money, you create your own con. And people won't back-check your experience, which is sad. This is why you get a lot of cons that completely fail, because everyone thinks they can run their own con. So the bandy cons really, really pop up around this time, and this is where we get, again, the dash cons and stuff like that. While the comic cons that are run for business eventually became more pop culture multimedia con. So even though San Diego Comic Con still has Comic Con inside of New York Comic Con, so it's a comic in its title, they're essentially these big mass conglomerate pop culture events, these massive cattle cons. And this is where I was originally going to end my book. I thought, you know, 80 years since the first WorldCon, the 50th San Diego Comic Con, the final BronyCon, perfect place to kind of end the book. And then the pandemic happened, and this kind of changed the scene, because it actually showed how well the bronies and furries were at organizing cons, because they were the first to kind of move on to the virtual space. So the first virtual cons during this period were actually started by the bronies on Discord. PonyFest Online was actually created as a way to kind of help dealers who were, like myself, who couldn't sell during the pandemic, and they decided to create their own things. Some of the later PonyFest partnered with an online group called PonyTown, where you could create your own little pony avatar, and they would screen panels, live stream panels, onto these screens where you could interact with them. The furries, of course, took that one step further and basically created the entire convention centers in
like
Second Life,
Center.
Where you could walk around with your own avatar in VR.
I was part of SC 2021 Virtual, so I'm very much involved
yes.
in that.
Which is, it makes sense, because if you think about it, what are avatars if not digital fursuits? And it makes sense that the furries would naturally move on to the space. You can see how well the furries and bronies do it, because when you look at how Comic-Con and the anime-cons adapted online, they didn't know how to do any of this, and they just marketed it off, pushed it off to other people who completely failed and corrupted it. But this is also where you get a lot of unique small cons, which would have never happened if it wasn't for it. So one example is FireCon, which is specifically a black-run science fiction convention specifically for black speculative fiction authors. You would never see a con like this happen in person, but because this is something where all around the world people could unite for these niche topics, we start seeing this. We start seeing cons specifically for queer individuals or exclusively for regional individuals. One other event was kind of Consolation, which was kind of the boomer version of all this. It was like a fun little Facebook group where people kind of helped get through the pandemic by posting cat meme pictures, and it was kind of fun because they were missing out these cons, so let's put cat memes on there. So this is where the pandemic was for at least 2 years, and then when cons started coming back, some furry cons kind of integrated this really, really well. So this was at Megaplex last year, and you can see, this is a picture I took from the physical space. You can see individuals interacting with the screen when you have all the people in their VR avatar Second Life characters. And this is a picture taken, screenshot taken from the inside screen, where you can see all the VR avatars seeing the videos of the attendees there. So it's a really great way to incorporate the online virtual cons with the new in-person cons.
Plurality is one, right?
Yes.
And they were at FC last weekend, and I thought it was very impressive what they set up.
And I wish that they still, that every furry con did this, but I can understand how hard it is, but it's great that this is coming back, but at the same time, I think once in-person cons came back, most of the virtual cons have kind of died out. So it's kind of sad that tradition didn't continue. But with that, that concludes the entire long history that we have, stretching all the way back from these old proto-conventions all the way to the new conventions. In fact, here we should actually start merging all these events, because a lot of these events are kind of just collating into this large, massive organism. I think furries, at least, are kind of unique in individuals, but anime cons, comic cons, and science fiction cons are all kind of merging to this giant blend. And with that, This is normally a video I show at the end of the final Veronicon where you're saying, isn't it great to be different? I think it's a great way to end the panel, but the audio is not hooked up here, so I don't think I can play it that well. But this is the final Veronicon, the final moments of Veronicon, and I think it's a great way to kind of represent kind of this 8-year history, starting from the small hotel in New York all the way to these giant, massive, 100,000 attendee groups. And with that, thank you very much for coming to my panel.
All right, you're welcome. Here we
go. Your party's happening upstairs. These room parties gave birth to a lot of the cons that we have now, so please partake and continue this tradition. Go up and support these room parties, and who knows what future cons will be performed for them. So thank you again. If you have questions, I can take some questions. Just keep your hand raised, and I'll try to answer them. Thank you again.
First, when's your book coming out?
What?
When's your book coming out?
I wanted to get it out this year, but the entire pandemic kind of messed it up because I had to add this new chapter, so it's a lot of work.
Two other quick things. First off, might be worth looking into the history of the Sherlock Holmes fandom, although I know the first literary site started in 34. It might have interesting things before that. And second, for a theme-related thing, the first railfan convention was in 1938. It was only a 2-day building film.
Yeah, that's the film con I was talking about.
But it wasn't sci-fi, it was rail convention, but...
Yeah. Again, rails are not the pop culture thing I was talking about, I guess.
Way closer than you think.
All right, any other questions? Yes.
So, it's interesting to observe, like, the sort of boom and shrink of some of these fan-based comics. Mm-hmm. You saw Star Trek get huge, and it shrink down again when the show was over. We might see something like that, I would imagine, with NLT.
I think that's definitely it. That's why if you look at one of the graphs, definitely boomed and tapered off. Right,
so it's always fascinating to me with furries that like we don't have a canon. There's no show or anything.
That is the only unique thing about furries. Because if we look at all the other cons, they're either genre cons, like fancy or science fiction, they are industry cons, like anime or comics, or they're franchise cons, like Star Trek or My Little Pony. Yeah. Furries are unique when they don't fall under any of those categories.
So do you think that there's no stop on this trend?
I don't think there's a stop. I think of the influx of bronies coming to the furry scene is definitely going to help it keep growing. Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, I think Corgi Events is defunct now.
Yeah, they're
you might want to scrub them or
they're its own separate history.
They changed the organization that they used to be for profit that caused problems, and now they're non-profit.
Yeah, it's a long story. I've been following for a while.
Oh, that's the same Corgi Events. Okay.
It has to do with a lot of states with their non-profit ranks, but they have other problems, a lot of other problems.
Any other questions or comments or?
Founder was.
Yes.
My question is, are there other, you've gone from the history to today, do you have a trend or something you're seeing that in the near future?
So before the pandemic, I thought online virtual cons would be the next logical step, that interacting with VR is a great way to have your own custom character that you can interact with in virtual space. So I thought the pandemic actually did what I predicted it would do, but the fact that virtual cons have completely fallen off now, that in-person cons are back, that prediction kind of failed.
Sure.
So honestly, I don't know. And the issue is they're becoming more of a monopoly. So remember I talked about Wizard World, like that was bought up recently by Fan Expo. So you're having these groups that used to run separate cons now buying up all these other groups, and eventually I think either Repop or Fan Expo is going to own everybody, and it's going to be the same nebulous cookie cutter cattle con that everyone hates, and that might be horrible. So we have to keep these small cons going. The problem is the small cons can naturally bleed into vanity cons, which end up becoming dash cons. So we need to avoid that too. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Isn't like Ferrari like? I think they're still growing, and they have like thousands of like attendees.
Yeah, they're. Yeah, some of them are still going, but they're not as prevalent as they used to be during the pandemic. And I think one hand it's good because you have a lot of international guests who can't make it physically to these cons interact. But at the same time, it's also harder to mingle with people in those spaces. I think it only works in the furry fandom, again, because of the Second Life avatar situation, which maybe anime cons could do this, but anime cons are not really about making your own custom character to show off. It's like involved with making, you know, cosplays of pop existing pop culture, which is why I don't think it exists in furry or it only exists in furry cons.
It's kind of similar to Ponytown, where you can customize your pony and watch the entire event.
Yep, that's why I had the Ponytown as a precursor, because like I think that really gave the furries the inspiration to do their entire Second Life stuff.
It was being the vice chair right now.
Are you vice chair for?
Yep.
Office? Okay. Fun. All right. Any other questions?
Okay. Just thanks for doing this panel. This is
yeah.
The best.
Yeah, I think it's well.
I wish I had a little more time so I could go through more stuff in detail, but. That's a rough in-year history.
There's been some interesting panels. At FurPoc, they had someone showing a whole bunch of the furry zines
mm-hmm.
over the years. You
oh,
know
yeah,
what
I
mean?
I saw that,
and a couple of the ones you showed there was one for a conference. I think I had that at one point, so I remember that. And you were talking about like the mimeograph sheets, the updates. When Anthrocon was at the Adams Mark, they had something called Anthro Content, and it was the same thing. So you did have some online stuff, but here's today's, you know, it would have a little bit of everything. So it would have some further info, and it was a pass-out sheet. But that was 2004. So you did have sheets like that.
Yeah, which I do like that some of the old world cons and science fiction cons still do it, but yeah, it's, I guess everything's just replaced with online stuff now.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, so like I said, the furry cons, unlike the other cons, took almost everything straight from the science fiction con and kind of kept it as close as possible before eventually branching off. But yeah,
right.
That's why you see a lot of traditions continue.
Yeah.
There was a comment earlier about how anime fans don't make their own characters, but I'm seeing a ton of VTubing lately.
Yeah,
so
one of my friends, Rat, is started a VTuber convention in San Jose, actually in the same hotel as Furry Confusion. So there are definitely
yeah,
a rise of VTubing.
Like it's on the verge of
it. Yeah, it's like its own new unique thing. I'm not sure where it's going to go yet, so I'm not sure I'm going to categorize it in this book yet, but maybe the next book. But yeah.
One of the things that's like, this actually goes for a lot of your stuff, is the attendance speakers, which this would be a good idea for you to dive into, because I've heard that different cons do count attendance in different ways.
Yeah,
especially the six speaker cons are generally doing turnstile attendance, where somebody buys a 3-day pass counts three times.
Yeah, there's turnstile, there's like hard body, there's a lot of them. That's why I don't. I was originally going to put
actually research that and get into those.
I was originally going to put a table of all different convention attendees in the back, but then I realized how differently they count. So like, for example, Anime Matsuri, no one's ever really heard of it, and yet it had all of a sudden it boomed from like a few thousand to hundreds of thousands. Like, no one believes this. This is a self-reported number.
It would be good if you could like find people in the know to actually try to get pin down some of these numbers, or like I said, that those truck cons, were they originally, were those unique 50,000 people, or was it 5,000 people who came for 3 days?
Yeah, that one I'll have to look into. I found a Star Trek book about the history of Star Trek fandom, written in like the 80s,
mm-hmm.
and I haven't had a chance to go through it, but I think it's going to have a lot of information.
When I heard about the different things, it made sense. Like, I couldn't see, like, how are there 100,000 people in that convention center, and then I realized, like, oh, it's like maybe 30,000 people who come all 3 days, or you never really have 100,000 at the same time.
But still,
it shows like an ACON type event at the Rosemont Convention Center with 30,000 actually has the same effective number of people as an event.
Very 2023 question, but how on earth does word get out in the early days like that before the internet to attract 15,000 people?
Fanzines. That was the original. Actually, going back to the Sherlock Holmes fandom, Victorian England had a lot of ways, especially after Jane Austen, you had the middle class group of fans who started to send fan letters with each other, argue canon and stuff. That's actually where the Sherlock Holmes fandom really, really took place, and that continued all the way to the early 30s, where you had a lot of these fanzines, and that's actually where you saw the creation of this. Like, we were showing the early comic cons came about because people were saying in these fanzines, we need to have our own legit convention, or else we can't really be considered a fandom. So yeah, it was all through snail mail.
How many people were willing to like find out through a fanzine and travel? And
yep.
Wow.
Today you're used to very low class. This gets out of history technology issue of, you know, just like all sorts of old technologies are just ridiculously complicated, but those all you had, so you didn't have.
There's three channels.
If you look at the postal rates, they had a jillion different ways to help people do low cost mailings of everything.
Yeah.
So the postal service was Google, and it was just send out like physical broadcasts.
casts of your little magazine, and it was very, it was affordable for people to do on a small level.
1997, Ed Zona's Mailbox Books catalog had a flyer for something called Albany Anthrocon.
Yes.
And that's how I got into this whole thing.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Do you have a question? Do you have a question back there? Okay. You have something?
Two things.
I believe I recorded a version. I think I recorded the last version I did at FC, so I'm trying to edit it and put the slides and my audio online as a video. So if you want, you'll find my contacts up here.
Do you have like a YouTube channel?
Yeah, actually, I should go to the other one. Yeah, so go to it should be Con History on YouTube, but I think actually either Con History or if I go to my transformation one, I think everything will be under Transform Artif on both my Twitter and YouTube channel is where I'm going to probably post everything. If not, it's very simple. I think I own the domain for Con History everywhere, so if you go to Con History on YouTube or just conhistory@gmail.com. I will hopefully be updating postings up there as well. And then the whole conhistory.com is going to be the website. It's out of date right now, but I'm hoping when I have a break to update it and put all the information on there as well.
Please let us take your money. I want to buy this book.
Thank you. Guys. Appreciate it.
The other good thing was at the beginning of the slides, there was like a Xena with a cat. Was it like a protofurry?
Which one? The. The beginning of this panel?
Yeah.
Voltoid transformation, yes.
I don't know if I had any proliferates. How far back was it?
There.
Was it this one?
Over there, yeah.
In there.
I think, yeah, it's all anime characters. Okay, it's 9:13. So all right. We should clear it out. Okay, thank you.
Yep. All right.